Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Joanna von Toggenberg, MIACON Partnership Coordinator for GVC Italia, a leading Italian international development NGO. At the time of this episode posting in June 2018, Joanna had only just joined GVC Italia, having been until very recently with the United Nations as coordinator of the Arab Integrated Water Resources Management Network. She's known professionally as an expert in water resources, but what's perhaps less well known is her expertise in competitive frisbee, and she's been a leading figure in establishing the sport across the Middle East. I spoke to Joanna online from her home in Beirut. So Joanna, welcome to Change Hackers.
Hi there, thank you.
And you're in Beirut?
Yes, I'm in Beirut, Lebanon.
Okay, so for people who've not been to Beirut, can you give me a little flavor of what's around you?
Okay, it's an incredibly vibrant city. It's a city that combines all types of religions. So you'll hear the call for prayer from a mosque, but you'll also hear the church bells ring. It's actually much more of an open society than people generally think. So young people walk around here in the summer with shorts and short sleeves. And, you know, you have both. You have areas where it's much more conservative and traditional, and women wear the veil. But then you also have other areas where, you know, you can go to the coast and jump into the water in a bikini. So there's a little bit of both and of everything. And it's a very vibrant kind of startup community, creative life. It's very nice to be here.
But not somewhere you're from. How on earth did you end up there?
That's a good question. So I'm half German, half Polish, and I grew up in Berlin. And I never ever thought that I would have anything to do with the Middle East or this region. And I actually followed someone here, an ex-partner of mine, first living in Palestine for 3 years, and then I got a job here, and I moved to Lebanon in early 2015. It's been exactly 3 years.
A vertical learning curve?
Definitely a very steep learning curve, especially when I first moved to Palestine, but then also coming here was kind of the more relaxing step after Palestine. It's all relative.
But you've managed to find a way of exploring your passions, both in work and play, whilst you're over there.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always been very lucky to have had the chance to have a good work-life balance and to pursue my passion both in work and in my hobbies. So I work on environmental issues, mostly water management, which is dearly needed in a water-scarce region. And my passion and my hobby, which is ultimate frisbee.
Okay, so for someone who doesn't know what ultimate, I mean, we've all played on a beach playing frisbee, right?
But yeah.
Ultimate frisbee sounds slightly scary. So is it a big frisbee? Is it bigger than anything else anyone else played with?
Or no,
is it really super competitive?
The item is normal size. Just the field is bigger. So we play basically on a soccer field, a little bit more narrow than a soccer field. And you play in a team of seven people versus seven people, and it's a very, very fast-paced game. So you run a lot. You can't run with a disc, and you only have 10 seconds to throw it, and you have a defender in front of you. And then what you need to do is make a precise throw to someone from your team who's basically trying to run themselves free. And then you score in an end zone. So it's very fast-paced.
Okay. So before listeners start thinking they've tuned into the wrong show and this is not a sports program, this is about change, we'll come back to this in terms of how this is relevant. There's a fascinating story to be told here in terms of the use of sport as a platform for building bridges. But we'll come back to that. What I want to do now is just sort of wind the clock back. I'm sure people would be interested in sort of how you got started. And if we just sort of take you right back to childhood and think about, you know, the earliest experiences the earliest memories you've had of being frustrated or angry about the world around you and things that you saw that needed fixing, and to the point where it became something that mattered to you.
I think as a child, you're mostly positive, and I believe strongly in the fact that you're born as a very clear and positive person. And then obviously you see things around you. I think what marked me a lot is I was born in Berlin, which was at the time, you know, there was still a wall around it. So there was a lot about boundaries and barriers and overcoming these barriers. And as I said, I'm half German and half Polish, and I grew up in a multicultural, multilingual environment. And we've always had people from coming in from Poland, you know, looking for work, come through our house. There were kids of friends or friends of my parents that that were trying to look for a better life opportunity. And I think that really marked my childhood and growing up to, first of all, have lots of people come in from different backgrounds that were looking to have a better job, better life, better situation. And putting myself into their shoes, trying to understand what was it, where they were coming from, and what are they trying to achieve. So this kind of like inequality is something I think I grew up with, and I've always been concerned about.
And was this something that you think was innate in you, or was it modeled by parents or other family members, people around you, who were showing empathy for the situation that other people were in?
Yeah, there's definitely several people I can mention there. Mainly it's my grandma. My grandmother grew up already in a very open kind of society in Poland, in a port city. So it attracted lots of people from all around. And if I think of my grandma, who passed away a few years ago, but if I think of her, I see like a grande dame, as we say. She was always incredibly elegant, and she was always a great conversation maker, but she would talk to anyone, and she would have emotions and be able to understand the situations of everyone around her. And she was very humble and also very, very kind and very forgiving for especially grandchildren who were getting in trouble quite often like me. And I think the second person that really inspired me was my primary school teacher, Frau Pohl, who really was an incredibly pedagogical genius, I would say. She was often approached by parents who had difficult children, and she kind of welcomed all of them into her classroom. And she managed to get even the most frustrated, bored, or disengaged kids. She managed to make them curious about what we were doing in a certain activity. And she very often took her classroom outside into nature, and she would kind of develop our love for nature and our love for the environment by making us curious about the things around us. And one thing I remember that this teacher told me later on in my life, looking back at where I was at that time, she said, "You know, Joanna, you were struggling with some of the material that we were dealing in school. You know, maybe some aspects you were behind on. But one thing that you were really mature about and really a little bit ahead of other people was involving everyone and integrating everyone into activities and conversations and kind of, you know, always taking a little bit of that leadership and organizing things for others." So that is something that I think defined my life later on quite a lot as well.
But she saw that in you well before you saw it in yourself.
Yeah, she told me that later. Yeah.
Interesting. So fast forward the clock a little through a few years, you then found yourself studying water management and taking a deeper interest in environmental issues, and then that played out into a career.
Yeah.
So maybe let's just have a look for a little bit at those years where you started making your way into working in environmental management. How did you get started?
Yeah, I actually went, after finishing high school, I wanted to explore the world, like I think many other young people want to do. And, you know, being very privileged and living in the EU, where at least at the time, there were hardly any boundaries and we could move around quite freely. I went to study in the UK. I first did a bachelor's in politics and development studies because I really wanted to know more about countries around the world and different cultures. But then I quickly realized, taking a couple of courses on natural resources in developing countries, that this is a problem that is concerning the whole world. And no matter where you go, there is environmental problems. And I like that idea because I wanted to be open to work both in Europe or developing countries or other areas, and trying to help them get on track with their environmental issues. And that's how I came into it. And then I really care about, I have a deep kind of sense of hurt when I see the environment not doing well. I think it's something we will need for our generation and our future generations. And yeah, I'd love to contribute to preserving that for our children.
Is that the same thing as feeling a personal responsibility for it?
Definitely. I try to, implement everything I preach. I try to first try it out in my own life, whether it's recycling or, water consumption and water saving. So I think you have a we all have a responsibility, and we can do much better than so far.
Sure. I mean, it would be a great start if more people were to do more in their day-to-day lives. But you've gone further than that and are trying to deal with things at a systems level, at a much, much grander scale.
Yeah, I started off working in an environmental consultancy in Germany for 2 to 3 years, trying to help different countries in the European Union learn from experiences from other countries. So if one country already implemented a policy on water management, that helped them get their rivers clean again, et cetera, trying to translate those experiences and help other countries implement similar things. And ultimately, that's very similar to what I've been doing in Lebanon recently, where we were looking at the countries in the Arab region and trying to learn from experiences there, share the knowledge, collaborate on projects, and implement stronger environmentally protecting policies. And before coming to Lebanon, when I was in Palestine, I was working on advocacy around water and sanitation. So basically letting people around the world know what the water and sanitation situation is in Palestine and how we could improve it.
And the communication challenge there in terms of building awareness.
Yeah.
No doubt in recent weeks and months, the situation in Cape Town has helped to elevate this issue in terms of a global consciousness about it. But how difficult has that been for you over recent years before these big pieces of news have come out around water scarcity to raise awareness? You know, have you found you're talking to deaf ears, or, you know, are people receptive to the message you're trying to get across?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think definitely there are times where people ask me, oof, you work on environmental issues, that must be very frustrating. And sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. You know, I think to those best practice examples of examples where things have worked, because these are the examples that can inspire us to do better. And definitely there is a long, long way between understanding and being aware of environmental problems and difficulties and then implementing a change yourself. And I think what we're working on is to try to make it easier for people to get from awareness to action. But it's still a very difficult challenge. And it's something that we're only now starting to really research how to create that behavioral change through nudges and through trying to be positive. I always believe that there's definitely been a period where I tried to make people feel guilty about whatever pollution or things they were doing. But I realized that that's not always helping. It's much better to focus on the positive examples.
But do you find people get blinded by the, or scared by the scale of the challenge and don't know where to start?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same very often. I often feel paralyzed. But I think everyone can do a little piece. And if we all do that little piece, it will be bigger. And of course, there are some things that we can't influence. But, you know, the environment and the globe is also has an incredible capacity to rebuild, to revive, to come back to life, even if we or circumstances have destroyed it. So I have a lot of confidence in the power of nature, that if we do our little part and our contribution to make things better, I think we can at least prevent things from getting worse.
Let me come now to your other passion around Ultimate Frisbee, because I think what you've just been touching on there in terms of the interpersonal challenges of getting people to work together, building bridges, healing divides, is something I understand has been a big lesson learned from sport. So do you maybe just want to explain to listeners how you got started in this getting Ultimate Frisbee developed in the part of the world that you now live in?
Yeah. Let me go back a little bit further and just Sure. tell you where I started playing Ultimate. So I started playing Ultimate Frisbee at university, and I really want to kind of thank the university system in the UK, because I really felt like it was giving a lot of time and opportunity to explore hobbies and passions, something that I think some other systems, the French school system is very kind of like structured, and I think it's very important to give a little bit of free time to explore passions, and in the current school system, I don't think there is enough time for that. So I started playing Ultimate Frisbee there with great teams, both in the UK called Mohawks and Brighton Ultimate, and then living in different countries throughout the years, also being able to get a little bit of their teams. An Ultimate Frisbee community is like a big family. If you play Ultimate Frisbee in one country and you come to another country, I have had people from a French team where I did my Erasmus year host me for the first couple of weeks when I couldn't find a place to live in. Just after I came to practice one time and introduced myself and told them about my troubles. So it's not just a sport, it's also an incredible community. And it's an incredible community that knows how to play at high level without and be competitive, but in a positive way, without alienating and putting down other teams, but actually seeing them as friends and rather than as enemies, and as buddies in and brothers and sisters in that Ultimate World community. So that is something that really attracted me to the sport, and it brings you very close to people, especially when you travel to tournaments and you spend all day together and you party at night and you sleep together on someone else's floor. And next day you have intense situations where you're tired and you're trying to, do as best you can. So that really brings people together. It's an incredibly forming experience. And after playing for a couple of years, I moved to Palestine, and wherever I went, I tried to, continue practicing my hobby. And there's a great organization called Ultimate Peace, which have developed a vision and a way to use Ultimate Frisbee to coach life skills. So basically respect and integrity and friendship and all these kind of values that sport can be used for. And Ultimate Frisbee is especially useful for that, because it already has a lot of these values integrated in the sport itself. One of the ways is called spirit of the game. And the spirit of the game is incredibly important in Ultimate Frisbee, because we don't play with referees, even at very high level. So the responsibility of fair play is put on the player himself. Every player is responsible for knowledge of the rules. And when a foul is called in a game, and the games can get very intense, and even though it's a non-contact sport, it sometimes happens. So then a foul is called, and the two players that usually would be upset at each other or maybe even shouting at each other on field, in Ultimate Frisbee, we teach our players to face each other, breathe, and then start talking to each other and explaining their point of view, listening to the other person's point of view, and then coming to a joint conclusion. And all that has to happen on field in about 30 seconds, and or in a limited frame of time. So getting to that place with young people is often a challenge, but we try to coach that through every practice. So during every practice after the game, and also in tournaments after the game, we get together in something we call a spirit circle. And we tell the other team what we liked about how they played, where they could further improve, and what we gained or learned from that experience. And then the other the other team tells us the same thing. So it's a really nice feedback tool as well.
Wow, had no idea.
Yes.
That's so much more than simply playing the game.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a whole culture.
It's teaching values and principles to young people. Do you see certain cultures having greater difficulty with adopting that approach?
I wouldn't put entire cultures into it, but definitely there is, you know, sometimes players that have played other sports that join Ultimate Frisbee, they're very surprised about that and very pleased because they feel, wow, we really feel integrated into the sport. We feel like we don't have to have all these negative feelings, but we're actually, you know, after a game, not putting ourselves or the other team down, but actually we're experiencing a lot of positive feelings, and that makes the sport a lot more fun. And I think I've listened to a lot of, you know, sportsmen and sports coaches stories, and they say the best performance and the most long-lasting performance of sports people is when they have fun what they're doing. Another thing that is, I think, quite unique is that it's a mixed gender sport. So the main division that we play in is the mixed division. So girls and guys play together. And that, of course, is a challenge in some regions, like here in the Middle East and some countries. Lebanon, not so much. There's a lot of teams where girls and guys play together. But in other countries, whether you go to Egypt or to Saudi or other countries, that is not a given. So we've actually, I think, managed to create a change. For example, there was a tournament we went to a couple of years ago in Egypt. And they were telling us, we don't really have many girls that play with us. So usually we play, let's say, 5 guys and 2 girls or 4 guys and 3 girls on one team. And they were suggesting to just put 1 girl and 6 guys. And all the other teams in the region disagreed. And they said, no, you've got 3 months. And if you want to host that tournament and play in that tournament, you better get enough girls motivated to come and join your sport in the next 3 months so that you can play, you know, according to the international rules. And that created such a huge change that they have more girls now than they ever could imagine. So it's a really tangible, inspirational change that they've managed to achieve. But also maybe to tell you from experiences and from change that I could witness through coaching is, you know, coaching in Palestine, in a community called Beit Sahur, very close to Bethlehem, I was really inspired by the kids there because they live through so many hardships every day. But coming to play Ultimate Frisbee, and we weren't playing on a nice soccer field with green grass. No, we were playing in a small concrete field behind the school. But the kids were so motivated to come and to improve so that they could maybe go out, meet some other teams, and live that unique experience. And we've made that happen here in the region through the engagement of all the different team leaders in the different countries. That in recent years, we've had a MENA-wide tournament, so Middle East and North Africa. And it's been incredible to see teams from countries where normally people can't go to visit each other and can't even speak to each other, come together and play on the same pitch. So we had a Lebanese team and a Palestinian team. Many Palestinians can't get permits to travel to Lebanon, but because we hosted the tournament in Jordan or in Egypt, they could come and they could play with each other and against each other. And that's an incredible sign of regional integration that hardly happens in any other field than in sports.
So just going back a few years to when you first arrived in the region, what was the level of participation in the sport at that point in time, and how much has that changed in the last few years?
Yeah. So I arrived in 2015 and I was looking for a team to play with. And since Lebanon has a lot of American and Canadian influence, I was convinced that there would be a team. But there wasn't. I couldn't find anything on Facebook, on the internet. So I decided to ask around. And I asked around, and after a couple of weeks, I heard about this American guy here who had just started putting a team together. And his name is Colin Campbell. And he's been really, really incredible in starting the sport here. And he's one of these people who is so in love with Ultimate and with anything he does, really. He will tell you about it and he will make you want to start playing and want to try it out. So he was putting a team together and then I joined to help him. And after a couple of months, he moved to Jordan, where he was also very strongly involved in the community. And so kind of I fell into that leadership position here to continue developing the sport, to keep up weekly pickup games. And then I don't even recall how that happened. We got in touch with some students at university and then they started a team and they needed someone to coach. So a couple of more experienced players and myself, we went to start coaching at the university. And then suddenly we had, you know, 40 18 to 20 year olds that were super keen on learning the sport and getting better at it. And they told their friends. And so it just snowballed into a situation where we went from zero teams in 2015 to currently five teams within 3 years that participate in international tournaments where we organize leagues in the country. And we also, in 2017, we created the Lebanese Flying Disc Association, which is recognized and a member of the World Flying Disc Federation. So we have a little bit of an institutional status now, and they helped us get a grant to bring a professional coach, because at some point, you know, when you have five teams and you only have three people to coach, it gets, you know, very intense. So a couple of friends of mine and myself, we were coaching nearly every day. And doing that next to a full-time job is obviously challenging. So we got a coach from the UK, Liam Kelly, an incredible player and coach. And he provided a weekend training to get more players from the local community to become coaches. And the incredible thing is that even though we started mostly internationals, started that sport here, it is now fully in the hands of local players and local young leaders. So I'm really proud of the fact that we managed to create something that is locally managed now, and where these young people also have the opportunity to try out their leadership skills and grow.
The bit that really interests me there here is that you perhaps didn't self-identify as a leader going into, but through your participation in the sport and the coaching role you've played and the role you've played in developing the infrastructure for supporting the sport, both nationally and it's how it plays into the international scene, you've grown as a leader yourself, and you're seeing application of those skills back into your work. Now, looking back on those past few years, what's your reflections on how you feel you've grown?
It's been an incredible growth, and it's been incredibly rewarding, but it's also been really, really difficult at times. So yeah, I fell into this leadership role, and it started growing beyond anything that I had planned or envisaged or even necessarily wanted to lead that. But I also take a huge, it's really fun for me to organize things. And you've seen that throughout my path in life, that I've loved organizing and I love to take leadership when I see there is a need for it.
From the playground.
From the playground.
But your teacher couldn't possibly have imagined you'd end up in the World Flying Disc Association.
Yeah, exactly. And so taking that leadership and organizing things was really natural to me. a big challenge there was that I tend to overload myself and you know, struggling with managing so many things. But then the real new challenge is to recognize that actually putting yourself in the spotlight sometimes is not the best thing to do, and that you want to, especially if you want to hand it over to the local community, you shouldn't be the one speaking about the sport. You shouldn't be the one, you know, being the main representative. You should let them come in. You should let them own the sport and then take it forward and take that leadership. So I feel like my leadership style moved very much from a kind of top-down approach to an inclusive leadership style, where I had to learn how to listen to more and more to the needs and the wishes of the whole team, as well as then letting go of my own brainchild. So, and that is a at times painful position, because you really need to trust that the next person will take it on and lead it forward in the way that you were hoping. And it also means to let go of your own expectations. So to accept that other people will do it in their own way, and they will also do it in a great way, even though it's not your own. And very often I've realized that the best thing you can do to motivate new leadership is to step out of that leadership position yourself and to leave that space open. And then if you have, let's say, created enough structure and empowered people beforehand, then they will be ready to take on that leadership. And then, you know, I've been struggling sometimes with handing over that leadership and then kind of not feeling so much involved anymore and feeling a bit frustrated about that. But I believe that we always have a choice, and I have made the choice that I want to, even though I'm not the leader anymore, I want to be the most supportive participant, the most engaged player, and the most available mentor if I can be. And that is even more rewarding, because now you don't have so many people expecting things from you, but you actually can give from your own heart, and you'll be thanked for it by the new leadership. So if any one of the listeners is in a leadership position and is struggling to give it away, I can tell you that it's incredibly rewarding to see others grow in that new position and to still be a mentor for them whenever they reach out to you.
That's a really powerful story. And you know, I'm left wondering sort of how this has informed your professional life. Are you trying out that kind of a style of leadership in the role you play? You know, really important, complex issue like water stewardship across a nation or a region, and all these multiple stakeholders you're trying to bring together, and where you've not necessarily got positions of formal authority or status within a network.
Absolutely.
Tell me more about how this has informed the way you work now.
So far, I've been working in the past 3 years with the United Nations, and it's been a really great experience. But at the same time, I was still at a, let's say, relatively low level of decision making, and I didn't necessarily have a team that I was managing. I've now decided to move back into the NGO sector, because I think, for me personally, it's a more vibrant environment, and I feel like I can actually achieve more through working with NGOs, and also because I'm excited to take on a little bit more leadership. So I'm going to start working with an international NGO working in the water sanitation sector next month in a coordination and team management position. And it's going to be a challenging one. There's lots of different actors and organizations involved. And I'm super excited about reaching out to each and every one of them, having conversations, showing them that I'm an active listener and that I'm really interested in their underlying interests and in what they're trying to achieve, and then trying to see how we can bring that together around the project that I'll be managing, around helping people. Because finding the underlying interests and seeing that they are probably very similar, even though we have to sometimes, you know, play into different organizations' agendas and clients' interests and beneficiaries' preferences. But ultimately, we're all trying to achieve the same thing. We're trying to make sure that refugees and host communities here in Lebanon have better access to water and sanitation, and that water resources are better managed. That has been a huge challenge for Lebanon in the last years, with, you know, currently 1 million Syrian refugees in the country for a population of 4 to 5 million Lebanese. So addressing that challenge is going to be really exciting.
So I'll be interested to hear, sort of going into this new role, you know, what do you know about the organizational culture? Is it a large NGO that you're going to work for? You know, have you got a sense of, you know, what the power structures are like within it, and whether or not your style of leadership is going to jar or fly, you know, in that kind of culture?
Yeah. No, it's I think it's got a relatively flat hierarchy. It's really a team. And this has been my experience with other NGOs that I've worked with in the past as well. In Palestine, I used to work with Oxfam, and now I'll be working with GVC. It's an Italian NGO. And in my experience, the people that are working in these NGOs are incredibly engaged, motivated, and really work for the cause. And that is something that motivates me a lot. And the NGO I'll be working for has a small office here in Beirut and a very large office in the Bekaa, a region where most of the refugees are located, which is something I really like, because being close to the people that we're serving is really important in order to understand their needs. And they have a very good experience with implementing water sanitation projects. The current project that we'll be implementing is funded by the EU. And I think from the experience from a couple of workshops that I've participated in so far, all the other NGOs are excited to work on these projects together. So one thing that I think I've been struggling with, and something that I would like to improve in both my current roles and my future roles, is I think a certain sense of insecurity and questioning sometimes whether I'm doing the right thing, whether I'm doing it in the right way, and just being a little bit more confident and true to yourself is really important. I think especially as a manager, as a teammate, as a colleague, one of the most important things is to be very genuine and to stay true to yourself at all times. And that can be very challenging. I think when I was growing up and throughout my life, I've always had the impression, if I work really hard and if I do all of these things for others, I will be more liked and I'll be more appreciated and more respected. And at some point you learn that, yes, of course, working hard is great, but you will not earn someone's appreciation because of that. You will have people's appreciation because of the way you are. And sometimes trying to make everyone happy doesn't always work. So I think something I would like to learn, and something I'm stumbling over sometimes, is that I try to make too many people too happy and try to make everyone happy and kind of forego my own well-being, my own interests sometimes for that. And then later on, I can't really be maybe so genuine, or I hold grudges against it. So it's something I'm working on all the time, every day, through listening to books. I love listening to kind of like self-development and leadership books and try to get information from there. I think a great book that I'm listening to at the moment is called The Anatomy of Peace. It shows you how you put lots of barriers, or you put yourself sometimes in a box in which you end up not actually being true to yourself. And by not being true to yourself, you let's say you get insecure and you end up treating others not enough as human beings, but as objects. And that is kind of a vicious cycle. So always being true to yourself is something I'm working on.
And that's not the same thing as feeling a need to be liked.
Yeah, that's another thing that I'm working on.
But this is very common. I mean, you know, as children, we all want to fit in. And as you grow up, you have to some extent, leave behind that need to be liked by others, to be popular, to fit in, you know, to be like other people. So at some point there becomes sort of a growing tension between being authentic to yourself and being the person that you think other people want you to be.
Yeah. I have very good support in that. My boyfriend is someone who's very true to himself and an incredibly good listener. And he just points it out to me directly. He said, I feel you're trying to tell me this in a really nice way just to make me happy. Why don't you tell me what you really want? And I think having an enabling and supporting environment like that, that know you really well and that will pinpoint exactly the weak spot that you're playing into, whichever that may be, because it's different for different people, is so important. Someone who puts the mirror in front of your face from time to time, but in a kind way and from a loving place, is crucial for your own improvement.
And that's not contingent on having a partner in life. I mean, you can find that through building high levels of trust in the workplace with work colleagues.
Absolutely.
But it's predicated on you being authentic and them being authentic and sometimes showing you tough love.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, it's good and it's easier if it's someone you really trust and you know that they love you and they do that out of the best place. And that can be a friend, a family member, a colleague or a partner. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So you're excited about taking on this new role. It's an exciting organization. You're going to bring your brand of leadership to it and hopefully grow into this new role. What's your hopes and dreams over the next few years? What's your personal mission? What are you going after?
What I'm going after, I think, is to make everyone around me have a little bit of a, or to maybe be a good example for people around me in terms of kindness, because I feel like one thing that's really lacking in our world is a little bit more kindness and empathy of everyone towards everyone. And I'm not saying that as a, industrial countries towards developed countries or rich versus poor, anyone who has feelings and emotions and who's experiencing a difficult moment. If we're all a little bit more kind to each other, try to put ourselves into other people's shoes, I think this world can be a much, much better place. And we'll all be looking out for each other a little bit more. On a personal level, I want to do the best I can in my job. I want to continue empowering people here in the region and around me, both in sports and in their other professional things. I'm really excited about doing a little bit more mentoring. I've done quite a bit of mentoring with a couple of partner organizations, amongst others with SEWAS and Make Sense. And I'm excited to help other young people in the region develop their own business ideas or their own environmentally friendly ideas. And on a really personal...
Why is that giving important to you?
I'm not sure. I think it's really rewarding. It's like making a present to myself to give something to someone else. And then it's incredible because, yeah, a lot of people just move on and maybe they'll never follow up because you've just met them at one training. But some people do follow up and they do tell you a great story and you'll stay in touch with them. And that network of one person helping another is really something I love, and it comes back to you. That is the great thing. There was an intern at my workplace called Mark, and you know, I was just trying to help him out with some contacts when he was looking for jobs or for feedback on some of the work he was doing. And now he's an incredible entrepreneur. And already back then, I was laughing and I was telling him, Mark, one day I'll come to you to ask for a job. And his business is going so well that who knows, in a couple of years, I might be working for him. So things come around and what you give comes back to you. So I think that's something I hope for in life, that everything or some of what I give one day will come back to me in an unexpected way, because I don't do it out of expecting to get something in return. But I know that someday it will. I may be very idealistic.
No, not at all. You're reminding me of that. Who was that American kid who started that Pay It Forward movement?
Yeah.
And get something going. It's tapping into sort of something that's very deep seated in human nature to want to be kind, but so many things get in the way of that and hold us back. So it takes people like you to show it, to encourage it from others. It's a bit of leadership in itself.
You know, the thing, of course, there are things holding us back, but then we always have a choice. We have a choice on how we spend our time, whether we scroll on Facebook or watch TV, or whether we use that 1 hour to have a coffee with a friend and help them. And, you know, I don't even see it as help. This is my fun. This is the way I love spending my time, to have a chat with them about their challenges and their career and how they want to move forward. So we always have a choice. And even when times are hard, we have a choice on whether we want this to affect our heart and our mood, or whether we just kind of move past and we focus on the positive things. I think that's really important. There's too many negative things in the world, and focusing on them doesn't help anyone.
Well, what a great place to end the interview. Joanna, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I wish you all the best in your career, and let's keep in touch.
It's been a real honor to be on your show. Thank you so much, Tony.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, Change Hackers.